This is the Financial Sense News Hour with the president of PFS Group, Jim Poplava. Since 1982, PFS Group has offered asset management and educational resources that have helped investors build, maintain, and preserve their wealth. Now, here's the Financial Sense News team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Then put your little hand in mine. There ain't no hill or mountain we can't climb.
It's Groundhog Day. It's the fall. The government isn't funded for next year, past October 1st. There's a debt ceiling crisis looming, and there's absolutely no plan to deal with it.
Well, the House is going to pass a bill. It'll be up to the Senate to pass a bill. I would guess the president would engage with the majority leader over there if he so desires.
What I will not do is to create a habit, a pattern, whereby the full faith and credit of the United States ends up being a bargaining chip to set policy.
Those clowns in Congress are screwing up a weak economy.
Not lifting the debt limit is unleashing a torrent. A river of no return. It is beyond cataclysmic.
These are obviously part of a very complicated set of legislative decisions, strategies, battles, etc.
Look, we don't have the worst Congress in the history of our country, probably in the history of empires. And these guys absolutely hate each other.
I know the American people are tired of it.
I got you.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of the Financial Sense News Hour, Up on Deck. In the first hour, Louise Yamada will be joining me on the program. And as Louise has pointed out, we've been in a bear market for almost 13 years, and it wasn't until about April this year that we finally broke out above the old highs of about a little over 1,500 that were set back in 2007. She thinks we've begun a new secular bull market. A lot of the indexes are breaking out to new grounds, but, you know, there could be some setbacks in the short term. And she's talking about, well, if you want to get in the market, some places where you can start dipping your toe into the market. So she'll be with us in the first hour. Ryan Poplava will be here to talk about what moved the markets this week. Obviously, Ben Bernanke and not tapering will be here to talk about that. Rob Bernard on fixed income. And, of course, Eric Townsend will be talking about oil, gold, and interest rates. That'll be coming up later on in the hour.
And I'm John Loeffler. And did the Fed do it? Did they blink or did they just flip-flop? Ben Bernanke made an announcement this week about tapering, and of course we'll have to see what effect that had on the markets, but we'll see what the long-term implications of this as well entail. Also, we did a thing on the whirl of worries in the fall that people tend to be climbing. We're going to do a checklist review right here, see how the wall of worries is doing. We can actually check a number of items off. They didn't go in the way that the fears dictated. And finally, we'll look at Big Ben's bewildering buller bears, because, well, now that the Fed's given its policy direction, the market went up and now it's correcting down and everybody's a little bewildering. So are you a bull or a bear as a result of this? Or are you just a non-committal bull or bear? We'll look at all of that on the big picture, especially whether or not you happen to be a bull or bear. And don't forget, we have a special appearance today by Jim Rickerts about currency wars and the effects of inflation. All of that today on the Financial Sense News Hour. But first, Ryan Poplava, let's take a look at the market drivers this week. Last week, when we left off, you said that investors were actually anticipating hearing about the next Federal Reserve chairman, with Syria taking a backseat, as well as the all-important Fed meeting this week. You said the consensus was building around a $10 to $15 billion cut in the Fed's purchases of treasuries. Well, boy, were you wrong.
Sure was.
But at least, darling, you have good company. You weren't the only one, right?
Yeah, I mean, not only did it make sense for timing reasons because of the quarterly conference meeting after the policy statement, which really only happens four times a year, but it also makes sense if we want to gradually taper and get to the mid-2014 deadline that Bernanke basically alluded to on June 19th. So not only did the timing make sense, but also, like you said, there was this widespread consensus that was really building, and it was very narrow. There really wasn't a whole lot of argument going into this meeting. And surveys, they were very tight. And we also had that John Hilzenrath article last week that painted basically a roadmap on many of the issues the Fed was thought to address this week. And as Centelli worded it, the guy is sourced at Wall Street Journal and thought to really have the inside scoop. So this just proves that the Fed has its own set of criteria that doesn't necessarily match up with investors or the media's agenda, myself included. And I can't remember the last time the Fed did something this unexpected. I mean, Bernanke, who has focused on transparency, has typically always eased the public into policy shifts, but this is taking it pretty super easy.
All right. Well, since it was such a major event this week, let's proceed and we'll discuss it here. Let's look at any other drivers you also might want to focus on that influenced the market this week. Looking at the actual policy statement and the follow-up Q&A session with the Fed Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke, what were the key elements this month that influenced the markets?
Well, to understand why the market was so surprised, let's look again at that consensus that was built before we look at the actual policy statement so we can look at the difference between the two. Investors were expecting the Fed would cut its treasury purchases by 10 to 15 billion. There was, you know, a small difference between there. Currently, the Federal Reserve Bank is buying around 45 billion a month in long-term treasuries and 40 billion in mortgage-backed securities. We were also expecting to get the first read on what the committee believes rates will look like in 2016. So this was our first look at those projections, and consensus was for a Fed funds rate right around 2.5%. Further, to smooth the transition towards the Fed's taper, it was thought that comments would be made regarding inflation, that the Fed would leave QE in place longer if inflation remained too low to sort of soften this initial move into tapering those purchases. The committee has addressed that quite a bit since June, that they want the public to continue to think of QE as data dependent instead of really calendar dependent, really thanks to that Bernanke slip in June.
All right, so those were the expectations leading up to this week, and maybe some of which was derived from John Hilzenrath at the Wall Street Journal. So this week, the Fed said no to taper. Just what is the Fed watching? What do you think the data are that they're looking at right now to justify a cut?
That's the biggest question that investors are really left with after this meeting. You know, the committee must obviously be looking at how far rates have moved up since even the slightest discussion of tapering began in May. It began earlier in the year, obviously, but that got shelved when numbers started to fall right around March and April. Now, the 10-year Treasury bond was near 3% last week, and before the jobs report on May 3rd, quite a few months ago, they've turned really around. We were looking at around 1.6% on that 10-year Treasury yield. So almost a 100% rise in rates in under 5 months with no taper. It hasn't even happened. So the market's trying to discount a lot of what the Fed's been talking about, a lot of what they anticipate the Fed will taper. So maybe the Fed, the Open Market Committee, is watching those rates and saying, okay, hold on, guys. Let's pause here. Rates have moved up too far. Let's give them a hook here. And they really did this week, announcing no taper. The Fed reminded us on Wednesday that they have a dual mandate, a maximum employment and inflation of 2%. So if inflation remains low and we still have high unemployment, high structural unemployment, you look at the amount of part-time workers is really elevated because of benefits and whatnot. And plus, you have plenty of pretty sizable pool to tap into to get all those part-time workers. Bernanke is going to keep the QE pedal to the metal.
Well, speaking of the Bernanke, the other item that was concerning the media and investors over the past month has been the next choice for Federal Reserve Chairman. For a while there, right as we went into our little August vacation period time there, Larry Summers was in the lead because of his connection with President Obama, while Janet Yellen has been the favored candidate by Wall Street. So Larry withdrew himself from this, candidacy on Sunday after mounting political opposition. How did the markets react to that, or did it just simply blow over?
Well, actually, traders were calling it the summer's rally on Monday. I actually think it would have been fun to have a guy like Summers as chairman. It's kind of like having Jack Nicholson on the stand. You know, could you imagine Bernanke telling journalists, you can't handle the truth at a conference? But, you know, Larry might have been like that. I think it would have been a little entertaining, a little bit more. But the S&P was up 10 points to 1697 on Monday following that announcement. But it also was faded in the afternoon. We closed nearly 7 points off of the day's high as the move from really 1630 the last week of August was beginning to appear extended. The market was up, you know, I forget how many days, but I think we were only down like one day in September. And I think that's also why the market has faded this announcement by the Fed on Wednesday, that big move up higher. And we've hit, you know, in fact, really, if you run a trend line across the May high and the August high in the S&P, you'll see that we're turning down right from that resistance level. Really, despite we had good economic numbers come out on Thursday, like the Philadelphia Fed survey.
Okay, well, it sounds like it's getting torn down. You know, a diplomatic resolution to Syria, strong Chinese growth, no Summers, and now no taper. And it sounds like we're checking off the wall of worry. Jim and I are going to talk about that
exactly
on the big picture later today. All that's left now is fiscal policy blunders with the continuing resolution and debt ceiling debate, which I oftentimes called kabuki theater. But it really could get pretty nasty in the rate we're going.
Yeah, that wall of worry is just getting torn down, and that's why we've had such a great rally. And this time, we probably won't have the level heads during the negotiation from Reid and McConnell like we had at the last debate. They both said they will not write any bills like they did last time when we were faced with the debt limit ceiling. And look at the splintering of both parties recently. Boehner and Cantor tried to piece a number of bills separately over the last month or two, but that backfired. And then there was the four Democrat senators who wouldn't back Summers. It's going to be interesting over the next month. The present continuing resolution, think government funding, expires on the 30th of this month. And the debt ceiling, there's some different ideas of when we're going to hit it, when we're going to break through it, and then obviously what the Treasury can do to keep things funded temporarily. There's been some debate, and we could see it as early as mid-October, according to estimates. So this is an issue now for the markets to reflect on, but I think this too, you know, we'll get through it.
Okay, well, that's all we have time to go over today. I mean, obviously, we'll always get through it when you think about it. I mean, we get all these worries, and as soon as you get rid of one whirl of worries, it's like, oh, here's another whirl coming right behind it. Anything else, speaking of worried investors, anything investors should be watching for next week?
Just over the weekend, we'll get the Flash Purchasing Managers Index from China. That will happen over Sunday night, and then we'll get Europe and U.S. numbers will come out on Monday morning. So straight off the gate, just like Monday was an important day this week, it will be again next week. And you look at industrials and materials, they've been hot. Do the results from those numbers from China over the last past 2 months. So let's see if it can continue. And watch, obviously, Washington. It will be important to the market again.
Until we come around the time of the year-end recess, and then everybody goes into hibernation again. Anyway, Ryan Poplava, really appreciate it.
No problem.
You're listening to the Financial Sense NewsHour at financialsense.com.
I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh, Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood.
Well, I don't recall stating that we would do any particular thing in this meeting. What we are going to do is the right thing for the economy. And our assessment of the data since June is that, taken collectively, that it didn't quite meet the standard of satisfying or of ratifying or confirming our basic outlook for, again, increasing growth, improving labor markets, and inflation moving back towards target. We try our best to communicate to markets. We'll continue to do that. But we can't let market expectations dictate our policy actions. Our policy actions have to be determined by our best assessment of what's needed for the economy.
I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh, Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood.
Up next on the program is Louise Yamada from LY Advisors. Louise, a lot of things to talk about, especially after this week's Fed meeting.
Yes, the market is quite a challenge, isn't it?
You know, Louise, everybody that I read was baking in $10, $15 billion worth of taper.
Right.
I did an interview with a guy out of London the day before the meeting, and he said they won't taper. So he was one of the few guys that got it right. But
exactly.
I mean, it was just like everybody thought they were going to do this.
I know. I felt like we wasted a month of listening to people. Don't you think? I mean, who knows? You don't.
Yeah.
Somebody asked me that yesterday in the morning. Do you think they're going to taper? I said, I don't have a clue.
Yeah. Louise, you remember the 70s where the Fed lost some credibility and they really went out of their way in the month of May to tell us, look, we're getting ready to taper.
Right.
And then, of course, the bond markets really backed up and they said, no, that tapering doesn't necessarily mean we're tightening.
Mm-hmm.
And then they do nothing.
Well, it seems as though they probably had quite a discussion among themselves. I'm not sure going into the meeting that they even knew what they were going to end up doing.
You know, this brings up the point about the unpredictability of markets and this economy, because it certainly hasn't been a steady recovery. We sort of go through fits and starts. It gets strong, and then we go through a weak spell, and then it gets strong again. But, you know, I guess the message that I got from the Fed is it's not time to take off the training wheels.
Exactly. Well, you know, the one who's been very correct on all this from early on was Jim Paulson at Wells Fargo. He's really been giving all the reasons why the market should continue and the economy should continue. There's a wonderful book, too, that you might enjoy reading, Jim, called Race Against the Machine. Have you heard of it?
No. Who's it by?
The authors are Eric, I'd have to spell it for you, B-R-Y-N-J-O-L, F as in Frank, S-S-O-N. And Andrew McAfee. It's very interesting because it picks up on something that I talked about in my own book about the acceleration of the productivity effect on companies, on everything, on the energy, so to speak, of the technological advances. And it's very interesting because it does suggest that there is a lot of intangible, which is the way I had addressed it, intangibles that aren't being measured properly. And it's conceivable that a lot of the corporations have a lot more efficiency leading to a greater profitability than is visible to the naked eye, so to speak.
You know, that's interesting, Louise, that you bring that up, because we've had this discussion here on the show where we've been talking about robotics. So if you take
right.
a factory in China where Apple may have 5,000 employees, well, their new factory in Austin may have 300 to 500 employees with robots. Have you ever seen that video, Louise, of the Volkswagen factory in Germany?
You know, I have some vague recollection of that. It's all robots.
Yeah, where you have this couple, they walk in. They order their car, and it's like made on the spot. You can see it through windows, and instead of Joe Blow putting on the bumper on the car, it's a guy with a lab coat behind a computer, and the robot's doing the work.
Well, I think the point that they make in Race Against the Machine is it's going to have a devastating effect on our employment, and that we're going to have wider and wider divergence between the skilled and the unskilled workers. And it's interesting because the Fed is concerned about employment. It's very conceivable that we don't put these people back to work.
You know, it's interesting because one of the consequences of that, Louise, it also gets on the education side. So let's say in the past where you went to work at a GM factory or Ford factory, you could have gone to work, become a union member, and go through their training program, and you worked on the factory floor. Today, what companies are looking for, at least from some of the companies I've been talking to, they're looking for people that have an engineering background, computer programming, because they're going to be operating these complex computer systems that operate these robotics.
You might find the book interesting.
I'm going to order that. In fact, as we speak, I've got Amazon on my screen, and I found it.
It's very short. It's a small book, and he's very concise.
Well, let's talk about the market, because we've got, it looks like, higher highs in transports and there for a while, at least until today, in the Dow. So what's your read on the markets now that we've gotten through the Fed taper, we've gotten through Syria, and I think
right.
we've gotten through Larry Summers? So
yeah, those were, I think, three relief rally potentials. which allowed the market to lift, but you're at new highs here across the board, and it's very impressive. You still have, from a weekly momentum perspective, the possibility that some divergences remain, but I think if the markets continue to move up here, the monthly is all positive, and we're continuing to lift above the 2007 and the 2000 highs, and that to us has suggested that it's potentially a new structural bull market. The question outstanding, of course, is whether or not it's artificially manipulated or fed by the Fed liquidity, or whether it's something that if interest rates remain stable, we continue to move up. And certainly, I just did a review of all the S&P 500 stocks, and it's very impressive. I mean, the uptrends are the plethora of the S&P 500.
You know, Louise, this is something I think some of the bears have forgotten, and that is, in 2000, we hit somewhere around 1,500 on the S&P. We got back up there in October of 2007. And now, 13 years later, we have taken out those old highs. So if you were in an S&P index fund, theoretically, on January 1st of 2000, and up until recently, you basically went nowhere for almost 13 years.
That's the definition of a structural bear market. And notwithstanding the very generous gains between 2002 and 2007, which were given up again, and now we've recouped it, you finally moved out. And it's like the breakout in 1982. You moved through that 66 to 82 structural bear market, moving to a new high. And that's exactly what's happened here, which has allowed us to make the argument that perhaps we are in the early stages of a new structural bull. And the European markets, of course, are starting to improve. We've seen a few that are looking better. So heaven knows what the reasons are for it with all of the negative news that keeps coming out. But I think it's very intriguing, and it says something, too, about gold, because usually gold does well during equity structural bear markets, but doesn't do as well during equity structural bull markets. So there's a question mark outstanding as to whether or not the structural bull for gold is at least waning.
This brings up, going back to the beginning of our discussion, one thing that we've seen since 2009, we've seen record corporate profits. You just take a look at some of the companies like Apple that are sitting on, what, $140 billion in cash. And you just wonder, in this kind of market where people are trying to assess the economic impact, where we're still at a very high unemployment rate, if it is this new technological evolution that we're starting to see now in manufacturing. You have people talking about insourcing in the U.S., the number of companies that are relocating plants here, not only U.S., but foreign. So you have companies that are making more goods with fewer employees.
Exactly. Well, with fewer employees, I think it's wonderful that they're coming back, however. I think that's a big plus.
Yeah, I think whether Apple builds a factory that's only 500 employees, it's the fact that they're, number one, building a factory. So that means there's going to be jobs for the companies that make the equipment, that build the factory. They're coming back. Mm-hmm. And that is job creation in itself.
I think it's very positive. It may be slow, but it's very positive. And I think the fact that it's slow is probably good. You don't get a bubble, so to speak, in terms of what's happening. But I think the other thing that's interesting about yesterday's decision is that it didn't do very much to the long end rates, to the 10-year or the 30-year. Both of them pulled back, but they're still well above their 2-year breakouts, which have suggested to us that there's a basing process there in terms of the yields, and that we are initiating a new cycle of rising rates, albeit very slowly. I think the 32-year bull market for bonds is over. And I think you use this kind of drop in rates to lighten your long end position, because the long end was not affected that much by yesterday's action. The short end was, but both of them are starting to reverse back toward slightly higher levels.
You know, that's something people forget, because as long as I've been in my career, Louise, it's been declining interest rates until maybe last summer when we got down to about 1.4 and we've been heading our way up. This is interesting because one of the thoughts that came out as a result of yesterday, and maybe one of the reasons they made the decision they did, when they started the taper talk, and when you think about mortgage rates are up almost 1.25%. So even though they didn't talk about tightening, they're still sticking to the 2015, now maybe 2016. The fact of the matter is, you know, mortgage rates are up almost 1.25%. So rates have gone up.
Right. Rates have gone up. And as you say, you and many of the people that have been trading bonds or working in the bond market have never experienced a rising rate cycle. The last one was from 1946 to 1981. And it's a very different environment. You don't want to buy and hold because your capital will depreciate significantly. And interest rate cycles historically have been very long, from 22 to 37 years. Well, we're 32 years into ours. Although the reversals from rising rate cycles to falling rate cycles are very sharp inverted V affairs, as when Volcker came in and raised rates significantly and then they plunged, the reversals from falling rate cycles to rising rate cycles are very slow, multi-year saucer-like affairs because each one of them has experienced deflationary pressures. And so in 2010, we started doing a little preparatory work for potential of a shift, and now we've seen a two-year base in rates and a breakout for the 10 and the 30, as well as the 2, although it's pulled back a little. They're all above the breakout levels. Two-year bases, I think, are significant and suggest that we're slowly, slowly moving into a rising rate cycle.
Louise, can you talk about when rates begin to rise, as you referred to that earlier cycle from 1942 to 1981, from roughly 1942 till the first peak in the Dow when I think it was 1966 where it hit 1,000. It would hit 1,000 for quite a few times, but it never got above that. But in the initial decades of that rate rise, stock prices were rising.
Well, that's a fascinating observation, which we have actually addressed several times, including in this past month's publication. And that is that, you know, people have gotten used to the fact that bond prices go up with the market going up, as we've seen over the past several years. But historically, the equity market can rise against falling rates as well as against rising rates, as you mentioned, from 1942 to 1966. It is when the rate cycle becomes excessive, when inflation started to pick up and rates soared, that the market itself moves into a bear market phase. And it happens in inflationary cycles at the end of an equity market rise, and it happens in deflationary cycles at the end of a market rise. So rates, I won't say artificially, but there can be a misrepresentation that rates fall against a rising market. That's what we've seen recently. Now I think we're moving out of the structural bear market for equities, and that suggests that the interest rates could advance here, which should represent the beginnings of an economic cycle and would continue until that cycle gets out of hand and we move into another inflationary period some 20 years down the road.
Lastly, I want your perspective on gold. You talked about it just briefly there for a minute, but we've got rising equities, which would imply we should see a rise in gold prices. That has not happened.
If we're correct that it's a new structural equity bull market, the gold to equity ratio always shows gold in a bear market when equities are in a structural bull market. And it shows gold in a bull market when equities are in a structural bear market. So what we've been looking at here, and there's no guarantee that the structural move is over. There are all kinds of other implications, the depreciating dollar, et cetera. But you've had a two-year top here, which we broke when the price of gold went under $1,539. And then when we hit the first low around $1,367 in April, everybody thought that was going to be the bottom. But, you know, you never want to try and catch a falling sword. You had a nice rally, and then that level was broken, and we went to $1,180. Now you've seen another good rally, and I think probably more of a trading range. The old concept, the bigger the top, the bigger the drop, and the bigger the drop, the longer the need for repair. I think sideways action would be very healthy. We certainly saw that in the 80s. But I'm not sure. We could have a further rally to 1,500. We've got that in print. But at that point, you're really up against the two-year resistance, and it's questionable as to whether gold is going to get through that. I think we see some sideways action in gold for the foreseeable future.
So from your perspective, as you look at the markets now, basically, we do have some divergences. We've got a breakout in transports, in the industrials. How would you deploy cash here?
It's a very good question. I think you start, if you haven't been in already, tiptoeing into some of the better looking stocks areas. The industrials are starting to look better. Obviously, I think that's part of the economic call if that continues. So, you know, you could pick up stocks that are starting to lift in that area from consolidation.
So industrials look good, and
the healthcare area has looked consistently good. A lot of that has been the biotech area and, of course, consumer discretionary, but that is a very large group, and there have been rotations. Some of the retailers don't look as good as, you know, like the CBSs of the world, the media stocks, which all come into that consumer discretionary area. It's a very diverse sector in terms of its composition.
Louise, what about the international markets? Europe seems to be picking up, and some of the other markets which have fallen overseas are now starting to turn around. Anything there?
Well, Germany has been the strongest and continues to look the strongest. And I think that, you know, they've certainly had a reaction to the Fed's decision yesterday. And we had seen some improvement after the first relief rally of Syria, which we shared with clients, and it's possible that that continues. And the developed world is still, you know, looking very good. Maybe we get some more participation from the emerging, which has underperformed for quite a while. But I think one day's activity is going to have to evolve into something a little bit more defined.
Louise, as we close, why don't you tell our listeners, you do a lot of work at the institutional level, but you started a couple years ago a newsletter for individuals. It covers all the major markets. It deals more with ETFs. Can you tell our listeners about it, please?
Oh, aren't you kind? Yes, we do. It's a monthly piece. We cover all the markets globally, and we cover the financial commodities, the gold, the silver, copper, and the currencies, and the interest rate perspective. So it is available. You can go up to our website and contact us, and we'll be happy to send out a sample and the information.
You want to give out that website as we close?
It's just in my name, LY Advisors or Louise Yamada. It should come up.
Well, listen, it's always a pleasure speaking with you. Thanks for coming on the program. Wish you a great day and a great weekend.
Thank you, Jim. Same to you.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com.
There's a new
So let me first of all say, I think Chairman Bernanke's been a great public servant, and what he did with QE1 was just phenomenal. Having said that, I believe QE is an extraordinary measure that should be used extraordinary time, dysfunctional markets, potential meltdown. And I didn't even agree with QE2, but as you pointed out, Joe, we are 5 years into a recovery. The stock market has gone up and up and up. We're not talking about zero interest rates here. We're talking about $85 billion a month. And I don't think the academics at the Fed understand the unintended consequences of the potential exit.
There is always someone for each of us, they say. And you'll be my someone forever and a day. I could search the whole world over.
Up next on the program is Rob Bernard. And Rob, no taper. Interest rates have backed off. We're back down closely to roughly, 2.75% now. We backed off that 3% level. So why don't we start with interest rates, your take on it, and what should investors do?
A couple things that are interesting. As you said, the 10-year wound up at a 2.73%. I think possibly the 10-year could get down to 2.5%, maybe 2.6%. As far as England was concerned, 291, Germany at a 194, Australia at a 393. So the world now is kind of coming off their higher rates. A couple of interesting things going forward is that Oakland, California today came out with their some interesting redevelopment bonds. A 7-year bond at a 304, 8-year bond at a 338, 9-year bond at a 366. And by the way, those bonds are trading at a slight premium now to when they came out. You know, the Fed surprised everybody. And of course, that's what the Fed is supposed to do. And they kept telling everybody that you know, we're data dependent. We're data dependent. And the talking heads and the speculators just could not get it. What's a Fed official have to do in order to get these guys to quit speculating? Because, in effect, they said it's data dependent, and the data of the last quarter wasn't particularly good, Jim. I mean, we had revisions of the jobs numbers. Last month was 169. The June and July were revised. And on Thursday morning, I caught Bill Gross talking about, you know, some of the things that would cause an interest rate increase. And he came up with an interesting scenario and said, you know, I think that we could have 3% inflation and a 5% nominal GDP before the Federal Reserve would feel compelled to raise interest rates. And he also weighed in that he thought Janet Yellen was about 2.5% inflation or so, somewhere in that neighborhood. So, I mean, you know, this is completely the same playbook, data-dependent playbook. Not only that, but they also talked about financial repression. Jim, you know this better than anybody else, is that financial repression was a big part of the United States economy from the 40s all the way up to the go-go years of the 60s. And guess what? We could have financial repression here in the United States all the way out to probably 2025, 2028.
You know, that's interesting because in their book, This Time is Different, Rogoff and Reinhardt talked about this very same thing and the way it played out. And they made reference to exactly what you talked about, is that financial repression that was put in place towards the end of the Great Depression and lasted well into the 70s until the bond market revolted. So, and you notice, Rob, too, that they also made some reference that, well, maybe it could be 2016. It seems like the goalpost keeps being pushed further and further back.
That's exactly right. And you think about it for a second, is that all of a sudden the housing starts, you know, got compressed. Refis were compressed. New home purchases were compressed, all because interest rates backed up 100 basis points. I mean, let's think about that for a second. Car deals, home deals, consumer installment loans for refrigerators, all that stuff is tied to these interest rates. And when they start backing up too fast, guess what happens to the economy? I mean, this is, it's I don't know, the talking heads on TV never cease to amaze me on their speculation, of course.
Well, who knows what we'll be speculating about. Well, we've got, let me see, the next crisis coming up. We have the budget battle, and you and I know, Rob, despite all the media hoopla and all the dramatization of the event, at the end of the day, the U.S. is going to pay its bills. So, Rob, any thoughts on what investors should be doing with their money in the fixed income market?
Well, I'm with you on this whole scenario. We've seen the movie before in 2011. The market, of course, back then had never seen it, and we took a big hit. But I think this time the market's just going to kind of take it in stride, knowing that right down in to the 11 and a half, 11 and three quarter hour, a deal will be struck, and we'll go on business as usual. But we are still doing a lot of laddered bond portfolios, as well as laddered tax zero coupon portfolios. In fact, Jerry Brown is about ready to sign something that says, you know, is limiting the amount of zero coupons can be issued in the state of California, and all the zero coupon bonds we have on our accounts took a nice bump today because of that. But nonetheless, I mean, bonds in general, keep them between 1 and 12, maybe not more than 13, 14 years. Ladder your portfolios. This is a fantastic time to be buying municipal bonds. Even in 2007, Jim, you know, we had 5.5% coupons for 15 to 20 years out. Guess what? We got 5.5% coupons 15 years out now, but yet our interest rates are a lot lower now than they were back then. So go figure.
All right. Well, listen, Rob, as we close, if our listeners would like to contact you, tell them how they could do so, please.
Thanks, Jim. They can contact me at 888-486-3939 and extension 118, and I'd be happy to talk with their personal needs for their fixed income portfolios.
All right, Rob, listen, thanks for coming on the program. You have yourself a great weekend. We'll talk to you next Friday.
Okay, Jim, see you next week.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com. Thank you.
course, you're seeing interest rate projections and inflation projections separately. You're not seeing them combined by individuals. Each individual is making their own projection. I think you're right. I mean, that we should be very reluctant to raise rates if inflation remains persistently below target. And that's one of the reasons that I think we can be very patient in raising the federal funds rate, since we have not seen any inflation pressure.
Joining me next on the program is Eric Townsend. And Eric, I think we need to begin with the Fed tapering. I think it caught a lot of people by surprise, although I was speaking with Jim Rickards, who basically said it was more of the analyst rather than what the Fed did that was surprised everybody, because the Fed was saying it was all data dependent. And then, of course, just as much as they emphasized getting or starting to taper in May, they went out of their way in June to say, no, they're not going to taper. The market stuck with the taper scenario. But then, of course, we got the surprise that we had this Wednesday with basically the Fed saying, look, things aren't as strong as they want to be. Now, I have my own opinion on that. I think a lot of it has to do with fiscal policy. But let's begin with the taper. As we talk about commodities, obviously, with the Fed still continuing to inject $85 billion into the market every month, but through its QE buying, that's going to have some impact on commodities. Although, I was surprised on what happened to gold this week. It bounced on it and then gave most of the gains back.
Yeah, Jim, and you know, I think this is a really good occasion to step back and look at the big picture, because monetary policy obviously has a lot to do with commodities. I would say even more so than it has to do with the equity market. The best way to look at this, I think, is sort of a three-way fork in the road. Scenario number one is what the government is telling us they want to see happen, or that they believe is going to happen. And that's where, whether it happens at this meeting or next meeting or the one in December or sometime, the Federal Reserve removes all of the stimulus accommodation that they've provided to the market. And the market goes back into a period of organic growth, a new era of prosperity. Everything's hunky-dory from here, and it's all great. Now, if that number one scenario really plays out, gold is done. I would say downside target is 500 at that point. I am extremely skeptical, as are a lot of people, that that would really work. I think that what will happen if they try to go down that first path is that they'll find that as soon as they really start to remove stimulus, and remember, what we're talking about now is just decreasing at the rate at which stimulus is being added to the economy. We haven't gotten anywhere close to removing it. But when they get to that phase where they're actually trying to remove stimulus, I don't think it's going to work. I think they're going to have to print more money, because they're stuck in a trap now where markets and the economy have become dependent on quantitative easing. So path number two is the one where we go through the motions of trying to remove stimulus. It doesn't work. And then we come into a whole second wave of quantitative easing. If you think of QE1 through QE4 as the first big wave of quantitative easing, they try to take it away. It doesn't work. And they come back in with QE5, 6, 7, and 8. That would be scenario number two, which I think is most likely. Scenario number three is because of political change. Maybe Larry Summers is out, Janet Yellen appears to be in, or who knows? Maybe Obama doesn't nominate Yellen and instead says Paul Krugman is going to be the next Fed chair. He comes in and says, no, look, Bernanke was doing all the right things, but not enough of them. Forget about tapering. We've got to double the amount of asset purchases that we're doing. That would be scenario number three, where they don't even go through the motions of trying to remove stimulus. They just continue with more and more quantitative easing. That really is going to determine what happens to all of the markets. I think we're still on the scenario number two, which is they're going to go through the motions, even if not at this meeting. They're eventually going to try to taper the stimulus, hike rates. It's not going to work. The economy is going to fall back over, possibly into at least the beginning of another crash like we saw in 2008. But I don't think it'll go as far. As soon as that starts to happen, as Mark Mauber has said, they'll print money like crazy and we'll be into a new round of printing. It's plausible that what happens here is that, you know, Janet Yellen maybe is the new heir apparent. She says to Bernanke, you know, look, I'm not going to have this policy that Larry Summers would have had. I'm going to want to continue with the easing, so let's not taper. Maybe behind the scenes something like that is going on, and we're headed towards scenario number three. I think that's what it would take for gold to go more positive here, because because what we've seen, as you said, is this was a huge surprise in terms of a whole lot more continuing accommodation than anybody expected. We got a huge pop in both treasuries and gold, and we retraced all of it in both equities and in gold today. And what I thought was particularly interesting, Jim, was this afternoon, on Friday afternoon, we actually saw treasuries rallying. So treasuries maybe are trying to push their way higher and find even a higher high than what they hit on Thursday. Gold's fallen back over. Now, we haven't seen it go down to the levels that we had before the Fed announcement. If we see that, say, below 1,300, I think that's an extremely strong indication that we're going much lower from here. What it would take is above 1,375, better yet 1,400, to tell me that there's actually a bullish trend in place, and I don't see it happening.
All right, so let's go forward. Now, we talked about gold. We're definitely going to need a catalyst, and I think once the market realizes that this is probably going to go on a lot longer, the Fed's balance sheet is going to get bigger than most people expect. At some point, at least in my mind, I think there was a little bit of loss of credibility for the Fed. And one of the problems that you have when a central bank loses its credibility, then the market begins to question itself, and it loses its power to influence the market. And I think that's, to some extent, Eric, what scared, I think, Bernanke in terms of the market's reaction when they first talked about easing back on tapering. I mean, when you think of the 10-year Treasury note going from 1.6% all the way up to 3%, mortgage rates up 1.25%. I mean, literally, rates double, almost doubled in a couple-month period of time, let's say between May and where they stand today. Now, they've come back a bit, but I think the Fed has got to be real careful going forward. The other thing I think, you know, at least in my view, that was happening here is Bernanke is sort of a lame duck Fed chairman. And so there is a lot of talk that much of the meeting and the decision may have been influenced by Janet Yellen, who is more in favor of something we talked about on the show this week, of a gentleman by the name of Woodford, who's probably the number one, let's say, monetary expert, who believes more of, let's say, trying to target GDP growth versus, let's say, something like unemployment. But anyway, I think the real danger here is if the Fed loses its credibility, I think they're going to have to be mindful of that going forward.
I think you're absolutely right, Jim. You know, the way I look at this is it's one further chapter in the story of how we've distorted important signals in the market. It used to be that economic conditions guided the stock market, and the stock market was a meaningful leading economic indicator. Now we've got this doctrine, or we've had this doctrine of bad is the new good, where when there's bad economic data, the markets go up because the people expect that the Fed is going to respond with more stimulus. So we have a backward signal, which means that the value of the leading economic indicator called the S&P 500 is reverse of what it's supposed to be. That was bad enough, but at least it was predictable. Now we're going into a completely uncharted territory of nobody knows what the Fed really means because they don't do what we're led to think they're going to do. Now what that says to me is we potentially have much greater tail risk. Because when the market starts to go either up or down, people say, oh my gosh, it's a big trend. I got to jump on it. They don't know how to interpret the data. So I think that we're going to see more volatility from here. And it really is a crazy world that we live in.
So as we talk about gold, let's move on to oil, because oil obviously could be influenced by monetary debasement, currencies depreciating, but there's also supply and demand. We're now starting to see the European economies pick up. The U.S. is growing, maybe not at a fast clip, but certainly a 2% economic growth rate is better than one. What's your take on oil?
Well, I still don't think that these high oil prices are supported by the economic fundamentals directly. I think it's mostly geopolitical risk. Now, we're seeing the price of oil come down as we speak on Friday afternoon, about 104.88 on the November delivery contract. That's really as a result of Syria fading from the attention of investors. But, you know, I believe that it probably is true that the August 21st chemical weapons incident is not going to be what the Obama administration is able to use as justification for an invasion, but I predict they'll find something else in the future. So I think we're going to go through a quiet period, maybe see oil prices come down, but of course it's hard to predict what's going to happen geopolitically. At some point in the next few months, though, if not sooner. I expect there to be another round with Syria. I don't think the Obama administration is going to be satisfied until Assad is out. And I think there will probably be some new incident that's justification for into Syria. That's going to push things higher. So as far as directional plays on oil, I don't dare touch it right now. What's working extremely well is the spread compression trade that I described 2 weeks ago in the program. It was 805 when I described that trade. It's now down to 556 as we speak. So about a 30% collapse in that spread. I think it will collapse further. A little bit late to catch it right now, but again, when we do see another geopolitical upset, it's going to widen that spread, and on those wides, I think that trade is very effective. And again, that was short the front month on WTI crude oil, long April, and it's basically just looking for this extreme backwardation to come out of the market over coming week.
All right. And finally, Eric, we've covered commodities. Let's talk about the interest rate front. Interest rates have backed off from their peak of almost close to 3%. Anything you see on the interest rate front?
Jim, I think it's really important to look closely at what happens next week. Now, what we saw with the Fed announcement was very understandable, which is bond prices go through the roof as the Fed decides not to taper after all. Then 2 days later, we're seeing them fall back. Well, that's a very normal reaction. When you see an upside trend start, it gets a little bit overbought, then it catches a breath. Are we going to catch our breath and move further up to new high prices in bonds, which would be to say low treasury yields, lower than what we hit after the Fed announcement, or is it just going to roll over and head back down? We don't have enough data yet to know which way it's going to go, but I think it really tells us how the market is going to interpret the question of those three paths that I talked about at the beginning of this segment. If the market thinks that we're headed towards Planet Janet, means there's going to be just more easing, we're not going to go through the motions of tapering, and it's just more QE from here, then we're going to see bond prices go through the roof. If the market comes to its senses and says, hey, wait a minute, they didn't talk about not tapering, they just said not yet, maybe they're going to do it at the next meeting or the meeting after that, and you see bond prices roll over, that's a whole other story. The thing is, we don't have clarity from the Fed because they're not giving us clear information. So you don't know what's going to happen. And I think that what's likely is, you know, Ben Bernanke smiles at Janet Yellen in the hallway, somebody catches it on camera and reads meaning into it, and the market reacts to it. The market has no solid information to react to. So what people do in those situations is they read meaning into insignificant things. And I'm afraid that that's what we're going to see, is small things causing people to freak out and react irrationally. And what we need is clarity from the Fed in order to solve that problem.
And now a clarity from the Fed, but some clear thinking from the media, because I think the next event is going to be this budget debate. They're already talking about it, building it up. And you and I both know, Eric, the U.S. is not going to default on its debt. But by the time the media gets done with it and the politicians thump their chest, they're going to take the markets on one roller coaster ride. And I just don't see that being priced in the market as it was in the previous years, let's say in 2011 and 12, where we saw volatility increase, we saw yields increase, and option spreads increase. We have none of that right now. It's just pure complacency. So any final thoughts as we end?
No, I would agree with everything you said, Jim, and I think that the key, again, is what happens on the debt ceiling debate. We're not going to actually default and never pay the money back, but will politicians push that up to the 11th hour, threatening a default as a negotiating tactic? You better believe they will. Will that cause investors to panic when they've got these kind of threats and they don't really have a clear message from the Fed? Or will people see through it and realize that it's political grandstanding and it's not going to last? I think there's more risk this time around because of all these uncertainties, not of an actual default, but of a default threat being carried to the 11th hour to the point where it really breaks the market. So I agree with you. I think there's huge volatility risk ahead, and I don't think the markets are pricing it in right now. I wouldn't be surprised to see everything that we got out of the Fed be retraced and then some to the downside by the end of next week. But, a message from the Fed to the contrary could send us the other way.
All right, Eric, listen, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow your work, why don't you give out your website and tell them about your newsletter, if you would.
You can find me at www.erictownsend.com. That's ericktownsend.com. And while you're there, sign up for my free Peak Oil Investor newsletter.
All right, Eric, listen, thanks for joining us on the program. We'll talk to you again next Friday. Have a great weekend.
We'll see you next week, Jim.
Looking at the next hour of the program, we'll be discussing the Fed's big flip-flop based on what happened after the Fed's Open Market Committee meeting this week and the announcement by Ben Bernanke regarding tapering. And then we'll discuss the whole topic of whether or not you happen to be a bull or bear. Big Ben's bewildering bull or bear as the market went up in response to the meeting, and then it's correcting downwards. But where is it going to level out? Is it going to be a good year for stocks, and has the market taken account of everything that's actually going on, especially the debt debate that's going on in Congress as well? We'll talk about that coming up in the next hour, and we will look at that checklist of the wall of worries we began a couple of weeks ago. A couple of those items can be checked off the checklist. All of this as the Financial Sense News Hour continues at FinancialSense.com.